Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. It is the Savage Nation, Friday edition. Let me tell you the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile who crashed my Jaguar. But first we have to listen to Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd. Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd on the Savage Nation Desafinado to set the mood and the time. Oh, I know what you're expecting, but you're not going to get it from me. You'll have to go to one of the other talk show hosts to get. Obama's a Marxist and McCain is a war hero. If that's what you want from now until November, you're in the wrong. You're on the wrong dial position. It's over. Leave me alone with it already. I really don't care anymore. I'll talk to you about it after the election. That is, unless there's a revelation here and now. It's enough already. Can we get on with our lives instead of focusing on these narcissistic egomaniacs who want to crash the country into the rocks even further? So please, listen to Desafinado, will you, by Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd. And I will tell you the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile who crashed my Jaguar. So as the music fades away, I want to take you back in time to a childhood story. Of course, it's a teenage story at this point. I had a friend whose father was a shady podiatrist, as you can tell by the title of the story. And he had a weird podiatry practice in the back of his apartment in, I think it was Sunnyside, Queens, somewhere in that area. I have no idea what the man did in the back. He was a very strange father. Everybody was afraid of the guy. You'd go, and he was very tall. The father was very tall. He dressed kind of shabbily, but upscale, but it was all tattered. And he always had a weird look on his face. And when the father was not in the apartment, the son, who became the Anglophile later on to cover up his origins, would take you in his father's podiatry studio, clinic, or whatever it was, office. And he'd say with a snicker, "I want you to see my father's rack," where he stretched people or something. And there was always something weird about this guy's podiatry practice. I don't even know what a podiatrist did. Something to do with the feet, but I think this guy did something with another part of the anatomy by implication. Now you speed the clock up. The son who grows up in this shady apartment with a shady father, who was off-beaten, guy didn't become a real doctor, has to, throw dirt on his origins. So he becomes more Brooks Brothers than anybody we know. He adopts an English accent, and the last I heard, he had married a rich girl, oh, this is a long time ago, and became a banker with the umbrella and the whole deal. Now, there's another element to the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile, which is my Jaguar XK150. Prior to the time that he became a pure Anglophile, he was still my friend, but that's before I left New York. And I had an XK150 Jag that I'll never forget. I love that car more than, well, most cars. Who remembers what car you love and this and that? But when I say I love that car, you got to remember something. We're limited by our language, English. English has one word for love. I love my car. I love my mother. I love my wife. I love my dog. I love this pizza. I love my new shoes. We're stuck with one verb. In Latin, there are 16 verbs for love, each one slightly more descriptive, depending upon the type of love we're talking about. So When I say I love the Jaguar, it's not like I love my dog or any of the other things I mentioned. Well, one night we were partying in the podiatrist's son's apartment. The father, I think, was taking advanced rack stretching lessons somewhere in the Grenada. And as kids would do, we got drunk and probably some other things were used at the party, who knows what. And he said, hey, can I drive your Jag? It must have been 2 o'clock in the morning. And you know, you're a kid. Yeah, here's the keys. So he takes the car out on Queens Boulevard, 2 o'clock in the morning in Queens. And, you know, he raced it out as fast as he could go. And his heart's pounding. He's sitting at a traffic light after, you know, he did this long run. The light's red. He stopped. All of a sudden, he looks in this tiny two-inch mirror that the Jags came with. And he sees a car careening right at the rear of the car. But before he could get the car in first, clutch it, gear it, and get out of there, crash, bang, boom, smashed in. The back of the car is broken off. And, of course, I've reversed the story. I think it was his Jaguar, and I was driving it, and I got hit from the rear. I really don't remember at this point whose car it was, but I do know who hit us. To this day, and I'm not making this up, you know, I know the guy's name. I remember it. He was an Iraqi. I swear to you. It was very odd because I didn't know of Iraqis at that time. But he was an Iraqi national with a pure. His name was not Saddam Hussein. I know that. Nor was it one of the junior Husseins. But it was an Iraqi national who crashed the Jaguar and broke its back. And, of course, that was that. Our friendship ended soon thereafter. Yes, it was his car. He came and saw it. And the back was broken off the car, and he started to almost cry. He didn't cry like a sissy, but he wept. And he said, you broke the back of my car. I said, I didn't mean it. I was sitting there. And that's the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile. Now play Desafinado, and I'll tell you why I told you that story. Actually, the song has more meaning to me than the story, because I remember when this song came out, I don't know if I can tell that story. Is that illegal? One of the girls in the crowd had a sister who was a Playboy bunny. She was older. She must have been 22. We were 17, 18, 19. Now, I want to tell you, Playboy bunny then was a Playboy bunny. Today, it has no meaning. Today, they look like skanks from the lowest levels of the sewer. I mean, you watch that show with that old degenerate bum. I mean, this guy should be... Let's just stop right there. I never saw anything like these skanky broads he has in that mansion of his. What is so interesting about these low-life bimbos he has with him? But in those days, a Playboy bunny was really something. I mean, they were the top of the heap. At least that's how guys saw her. Who knows what they really were? They probably like every other woman on earth. You know, if they had a good figure, they became a Playboy bunny. As long as they did the right producer meet, you know. Well, this song was very popular at that time, you see, and she was 22. And everybody in the crowd wanted to get next to the Playboy bunny. But I was the lucky one that penetrated the ovum. And on the way home from that particular event, which, of course, I was flying high, I couldn't believe it, I was not in the Jaguar. I was in another car. I was in a Chrysler, which had the Hemi engine, but it was not whatever. It was a Chrysler New Yorker, an old man's car, but it had the Hemi engine. So I'm driving home from that encounter with the Playboy bunny. And remember, I'm really only a kid. And my mind was certainly not in the car. I mean, where was I? I have no idea. My mind was on cloud nine. Bang, hit from the side by a truck. The car is absolutely totaled. I got to get a tow truck. It's towed home to in front of the house. And I remember selling the car for the engine alone to some hitter kid who was going to take the engine out. We had a long talk about it and use it in a dragster. And that's that. New York, Jennifer, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say I just started listening to your show a couple weeks ago, and it had been recommended by a very good friend of mine for years to listen to you, and I started 2 weeks ago, and now I'm hooked. I'm a listener. I come home every chance I get, and I run home to listen to you. And I already donated to your fight against care.
Wow.
And I just think you're awesome. I mean, I've been a conservative in my, you know, political views. I don't really like the word conservative, but I've been more, yes, towards.
Right. I understand you. And you're not a Marxist. So the only option in America is to say you're a conservative.
Exactly. And I've grown up in New York. I grew up in Brooklyn, which is, you know, like in a very, you know, a pretty.
Yes, and Brooklyn is the equivalent of every liberal community in the world.
I mean, I grew up
condensed. Brooklyn is like the espresso of liberalism. In other words, if other regions of America are the coffee of liberalism, Brooklyn is the espresso of liberalism.
And I see it, because now I live in Manhattan, and when I go back, I'm pretty like...
Manhattan is the double espresso of liberalism.
Well, I just want to tell you, like, when you said last night how, you know, like, sometimes, like, you're on your cell phone, and you'll say provocative things or things that, like, you know are going to get people upset.
Well, I'm on a cell phone, and I start to say Obama's a Marxist. How could you vote for that phony with big ears? And I do it in front of liberals just to get them crazy. Don't tell me you do the same thing, Jennifer.
I do. Well, this is what I do when I'm taking the bus to work in the morning. So, like, you know, I start talking and, you know, it's kind of loud. And then I thought maybe keep it down. And then I said, no. I was like, I want people to hear. I want people to see that, like, a 30-year-old woman who looks, you know, clearly looks Jewish is not on the liberal side. And I say things loud.
What do you look like? Which of the girls in Sex and the City would you say you most closely approximate?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm just trying a popular connection here so that the people listening to this show across the country could connect with you. Now, I would assume that you don't have an easy time dating men in New York if you're not a super lib, right?
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of quiet on that side anyway. I'm just kind of shy, but, you know, I'm probably more conservative in that area too. But
well, that's your business anyway. It's not mine. But I want to say thank you because we only have 10 women listeners across the country. Although I have 10 million listeners, only 10 of them are women. The rest are men. So you're in a very, very rare club. And I want to thank you for listening. I really do. And thank you for making that donation. But wait a minute. Hold on. Jennifer, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you a free gift today because I'm in a very generous mood. Let me see. I will send you a copy of one of my books. No, I'll send you what? The Freedom of Speech DVD is an easy thing to send, okay? You're going to love it because you're going to get to see me with my dog, Teddy, in action on a DVD and giving the most important speech ever given in the history of talk radio. So stay on the line, guys. Get Jennifer's number and send it to the Fulfillment House in Florida. Now, before I take my first break, I got to tell you why I opened with the story today of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile who crashed my Jaguar. It was because yesterday I did 2 hours of regular radio. In the third hour, I went into storytelling. I read from my new autobiography as I'm editing it and getting it ready. And I got so enraptured with it that the hour flew by. There was no fatigue, no exhaustion, no boredom, no tension. It was pure joy. It was music. And then I said, you know, people who listen in the third hour generally don't listen in the first hour. So I thought I would begin today's show with a personal story from the past. Because perhaps I thought that would trigger your input of your stories that relate to my stories or your requests for any of my favorite stories or the favorite stories that I've told over the years. And of course, if necessary, if you force me to it, I will go into Clinton, McCain, Obama. I mean, my God, if you want that, can't you get it from the garbage man's son? Can't you get it from that chick, Andy Mitchell, who was married to the guy with the money guy? Can't you get it from any of these people who don't have any imagination or brains? Why do you have to bother me with politics? The leprechaun specializes in it because he has no past and no history. Wallbanger specializes in this because he has no past and no history. The golfer specializes in Dems bad, Repubs good because he has no history. I am very lucky. I have a very rich history that can be very political. You understand that. But it also, you know, there's a time and a place for everything. I don't want to do it anymore. This is too much already. It's over. Let's forget it. You know, they're only talking to themselves. Now you turn on MSNBC this morning and you see Andy Mitchell talking to Tom Brokaw now. I need his opinion like I need my dog's opinion. In fact, I'd rather have my dog's opinion on the election than Tom Brokaw. I'll be right back.
Savage.
See, liberalism is a mental disorder on all levels. Now, I am an immigrant son. My family came here legally. Here's a story that should get you alarmed. But, of course, psychopathic progressives can't get alarmed about anything except people who love America. Tainted cheese fuels TB rise in California. So what we have now are immigrants primarily from Mexico who won't buy the white man's cheese. Oh, ese. We don't want that Anglo cheese. So they're making cheese in a bathtub, inch bathtubs, queso fresco cheese. And it's largely contaminated with Mycobacterium bovis. It's a strain of TB that was largely wiped out until our dear friends broke through the border, thanks to Bill Clinton and George Bush. And as a result, this rare strain of TB is increasing in San Diego County, particularly among children who drink or eat dairy foods made from the milk of infected cattle. Now, this was just published in the journal Emerging Infectious Diseases. Now, of course, with the open borders, this journal should be doing very well, since it's called Emerging Infectious Diseases. But you see, this germ can infect anyone, even good liberals, who might eat contaminated fresh cheeses sold by street vendors smuggled across the Mexican border, or produced by families who try to make a living selling so-called bathtub cheese made in home tubs and backyard troughs. And, of course, the emphasis is on the word a trough. What you don't know is that this strain of tuberculosis, M. bovis, is a disease of antiquity, and yet it's reemerging in the United States. Isn't immigration wonderful? Isn't it great how they all come here to work and bring so many positive things to America? It's really good. It's really nice that we are experiencing a meltdown from a first world country into a second world country. By 2005, that is the year, more than half the M. bovis cases were diagnosed in children younger than 15. Nearly all of the cases were in Hispanics. Now, we could say that the Mycobacterium is racist, and we could sue the Mycobacterium, but I don't think that the shyster lawyers would collect. I don't think that the Mycobacterium have any bank accounts that the shyster lawyers could collect from. But the fact of the matter is, nearly all the cases were in Hispanics, and 60% were people from, you guessed it, Mexico. From Mexico. So we don't want to worry about this new epidemic. Bathtub cheese, what's next? Hey, who knows? Essay, who knows, essay? As long as it's not the white man's cheese, it's got to be good for you. So there it is. Yeah, immigration is terrific, particularly for those in agribusiness and agri-hotels, you know, who want slave labor, who don't have to pay benefits. But as you well know, you're paying for the benefits. You're paying for health care costs. That's why your hospitals are melting down. And you're paying for educational costs, which is why so many states are bankrupt and why the cowardly governors won't tell you.
Savage.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem, que passa.
It is a different kind of show, you know, I admit it. It's Friday anyway. This is Decifanato with Raul Gilberto and Stan Getz from the same era on the Savage Nation. It's Rock and Roll Friday, I admit. I am sacrificing another night's sleep for your listening pleasure in that I've had a double espresso again. I didn't sleep all night last night, but what a show I did. It may be worth it. You know, your heart pounds all night. Your mind races. Oh, this is the girl from Ipanema. This was a huge hit. This was by Gilberto and Stan Getz. Excellent. All right, it's enough already with it. They don't understand Portuguese. Caffeine content of coffee. Has anyone ever had a coffee enema? I haven't, but I'm asking for a reason. I once had a medical doctor friend when I was in the alternative health world who gave coffee enemas. He's since been disqualified. He was thrown out of California, I think, for putting mummy dust in people's ears. I don't know what he did. He actually was a very nice and intelligent medical doctor, but he got way into this alternative medical thing 20 years ago. He had to flee the state and nice people, but he was specialized in coffee enemas. I used to argue with him. In fact, we had a long argument about I said coffee enemas are dangerous. I explained why. It was about how when you put coffee into the wrong side of the alimentary canal, it was about the absorption through the mucous membranes rather than through the mouth and blah, blah, blah. And he didn't understand it. I said, you can wind up damaging the liver. But then again, whatever. No one listened to me. The people who are making a fortune in the alternative medical world are very much like the Republicans who are making a fortune in the conservative world, but they were damaging the body politic in either case. San Francisco, Norm, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, Dr. Savage, your Jaguar violent death story hit such a tender nerve. My mom had saved up. In 1967, she went down to Gibson, British, and Fremont, bought herself a brand shiny new black-on-black XKE 4.2-liter convertible.
Beautiful car. Gorgeous car.
It was the last year of the glass on the headlights and the three SU carburetors. She loved that thing to death. We were going up through Sacramento, and some guy in this big old green, like Chevy or something like that, with his rear bumper sticking out, it was kind of clipped and bent already, cut her off. It cut the front of one of the front wheel wells and wrenched the whole hood sideways.
Oh, that's the hood that came forward. It pulled the entire hood off the car?
At that time, the car was $5,750 brand new. The hood was $1,200. The guy pulled over. He was a Latin guy, spoke pretty good English at the time. The cop showed up. The guy didn't understand any English at all. And his name was Smith. So mom had to eat the price.
Oh, is he the brother of Wesson?
I hope not.
He was Wesson's brother, I think. It's a heartbreaker when a thing like that happens to a machine of beauty. There's no question that we love our machines in America, no matter what happens to the cost of gasoline. Did you see what happened to oil today? The price? It's frightening.
Oh, it's craziness, yeah.
I got to talk about that for a minute. Truck drivers in this country, how are they going to make a living? $5.25 a gallon of diesel fuel? Why doesn't the government step in and stop this? Answer. And Norman, thank you for the call. I thought about this last night, and I realized that this is the equivalent of when agribusiness took over the family farm and destroyed the family farm. This is a plan by the government and the oil companies to destroy the independent trucker, in my opinion. Why do I say that? They want to drive the independent trucker out of business so that the few companies will run the entire trucking business. They want to conglomerate it again. The same way agribusiness under Ronald Reagan destroyed the family farm. And believe me, no matter what good Ronald Reagan did, and he did a lot of good, he did a lot of harm as well. It's never talked about. I remember when Ronald Reagan was destroying the family farms in this country and men were shooting themselves. Farmers who had inherited their farms from their grandfather, men wound up shooting themselves as their farms were being auctioned off. I remember reading it in the 80s. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it was Reagan who did it through his policies of conglomerating into the farms into agribusiness holdings. It's the same thing in trucking, in my opinion, going on under another Republican administration under George Bush. I know this is considered blasphemy to those of you who are, let us say, didactic Republicans, but it's nothing I can do to help you other than tell you the truth. The reason diesel is out of control is they want to drive the independent trucker off the road. Once that's done, then diesel will drop down radically. You're going to see what's coming here. Because if we had a rational government, they would not permit this to happen. The independent trucker is how most things are moved around in this country, and they're being killed. They're being destroyed. San Francisco, Diane, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. I want to differ with you on your opinion that you have 10 female listeners, because I have a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old, both daughters, who also listen to you. And as you see with me calling, I listen to you. So there's at least three in your backyard that listen, and they are also having their friends listen.
Wait, where? In San Francisco, there are three females listening to this show at this time?
There's more than that, but you know what? This is Mill Valley, even closer.
Mill Valley in Marin County, Barbara Boxer's backyard?
Absolutely.
Are you allowed to listen to the Savage Nation in Marin County?
Only if you do it quietly, huh?
Well, I know if you turned it up loud in the backyard, they would call the Mill Valley police.
Absolutely.
Hey, thank you. God bless you. I joke around when I say of the 8 to 10 million listeners. And, you know, that's an estimate by the rating services. But the women in generally in talk radio, they're not – the largest percentage is men. And that's the truth of it. But I think that's going to change as the country starts to become increasingly – unfriendly to women and families. And I mean traditional families. I don't mean the monstrous turkey-baster families. As the nation becomes increasingly unfriendly to the traditional American family, the women are going to turn more and more to conservative talk radio. That's what is going on anyway, because they're certainly not going to get this from the local newspaper or from the TV. But again, I don't want to sit here and blow my own horn. It's a waste of time. Well, let's see. It's Rock and Roll Friday, and I'm going to take your calls at 1-800-449-8255. Soon I will turn to my website and direct you to the stories. We roughly get 150,000, 180,000 people a day now total on the website. It doesn't vary. It's amazing. No matter how many times I mention it, it's about the same number. What happens is it's sort of like a regular listenership, regular readership. People just go there on their own, no matter what you say or don't say. Even the days I'm not here, I get the same, roughly. And so, therefore, that's a big relief to me. I don't have to, plug anything. But since it's Rock and Roll Friday on the Savage Nation, and since I've had my espresso, and since I'm not going to sleep tonight anyway because I'm sacrificing tonight's sleep for today's show, as I did last night. I've been up, I think, for about 36 hours. No, I slept, but I didn't sleep. It was like a tossed, horrible, the nightmares were daymares in the middle of the night. But there was nowhere to go in there. The problem is I have nothing to do in the middle of the night. What do you do in the middle of the night when you can't sleep? I have answers to that, too. Because there was a period in my life that I was totally insomniac, and I thought I would die from a lack of sleep. And then I read a lot of books on insomnia, and I found out that insomnia can be your best friend. What it means is you don't really need to sleep. You're not tired. Most of us sleep when we don't even have to, incidentally. This is a myth that you have to sleep. It's like a myth like you have to have 3 meals a day, or that you have to drink 8 glasses of water or three cups of milk a day or whatever. You're not tired, so you're not sleeping. The trick is to not lay in bed. I remember reading one book during this period when I couldn't sleep, and it was mainly money worries. It was money worries because of a lot of reasons, whatever. The kids were young, and I was worried about their future and my future, and what am I going to do? And I killed myself, and they won't hire me because I'm a white male, and they're hiring idiots and morons and putting them into jobs they're not qualified for, and perverts, which, of course, was 100% true. Just take a look at your universities today, putting what they're doing in the universities outside the science departments, which, of course, unfortunately for them, they can't yet populate with their inferior plants, because either you understand the periodic table of the elements or you don't. You can't quite do what you do in the social sciences. Nevertheless, I'm up, I'm this and that. So I get a book that says more people have died worrying about a lack of sleep than from a lack of sleep. And I forget who wrote the book. And it was like 10 things you could do. Someone's going to write this down, steal it, and make a book out of it probably. That's okay. I don't really care. Go ahead and do it. And I learned a lot of different techniques. The number one thing was I went out on my deck and looked at the stars. And that's when I started to love stars again after childhood. You see, okay, I'm up. It's dark. The sky is black. The stars are bright. What am I going to do with the time? How about getting out a book that shows me star formations? So there they were. And slowly, and the next one is learn to read, learn to do this, learn to do that. And before long, when you stop worrying about not sleeping, you wind up sleeping again. It's like everything else. You understand that or not? Sure, it's like everything else. There used to be an adage amongst guys that a lot of guys are always hungry for a date for a woman and they couldn't get one. And the guys who did always had the same story to tell, which is that women can tell when you're nervous and you want a woman, and they'll avoid you like you have leprosy. That the only guys women want are the ones who don't want them or let's say are aloof and really don't care. It's a terrible reality. It's the same the other way too, by the way. You get desperate, the other party can sense it like an animal. Well, how is it put? We pursue that which retreats. Have you heard that one in the dating world? It's pretty much true in the business world as well. We pursue that which retreats. So the best thing to do is retreat even when you want to pursue in most cases. It's a terrible rule, but it's like hunting and you ask a hunter, there's only one way to hunt, or there's only a particular few ways to hunt, and none of them consist of rushing right at the animals. But that's neither here nor there. So let's go back to the insomnia before I get too far off the track. There are many other things you can do. And, of course, I learned to use passion flower herbal tea. I was very into the whole story there. And that's a great – wait, hold it. There's my story. Let me tell you how I learned to use passion flower herbal tea and how not only did it give me relief from insomnia, but I then learned to carry this tea around with me all over the world in my travels, and it became a great relaxant on airplanes. I didn't have to drink any alcohol. I didn't need the 2 little bottles of wine that they used to have in those days. Remember those days they served you wine in those 2 little bottles that you got, the El Cheapo wine bottles that were on airplanes? Now it's bottled wine. Well, anyway, so I heard about a guy, a pharmacist in San Francisco on Ellis Street. He was like an old guy, about 85, 88 at the time. And he was an old timer going way, way back. I don't know what his name was. He was an old Jewish guy named Morris. He was right near the Glide Memorial Church, as a matter of fact, which is a largely African-American church. and I forget the name of the pharmacy. He's since passed on. I go in there because I heard he knew everything about herbal medicine. He was a real pharmacist as opposed to people who were faking it with chlamydia and half mustaches in the health food stores. And I come in, and right away I say to him, "Do you have a passion flower herbal tea?" He says to me, "Why, who are you? What do you want?" It was like right out of Brooklyn, and the guy, it was in San Francisco. I said, no, I just, he said, "What, are you an inspector with the FDA? I have nothing. Get out of my store." That's how it started. I'll tell you the rest when I come back on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes.
Barack Hussein Obama has to be the most arrogant candidate in the history of the presidency. He says in 2016, I'll be wrapping up my second term as president. I don't understand how anyone can't see the narcissism and arrogance of this dangerous character. But we'll get into that another day. What did I want to talk about? Who knows? What, the heat wave in the East Coast? What, that's a story. It's June, so you got a heat wave on the East Coast. Hottest in years. We're enjoying beautiful weather here in the Bay Area, by the way. We don't have the hottest weather on Earth. And for those of you who keep talking about, you know, anthropomorphic causes of global warming, I have to remind you, 1870s, California Valley got so hot that the cornfields caught fire just from the heat. I think it was 1876 or something around there, in that era, you know, sort of before the car, before Al Gore's grandfather had a glint in his eye for Al Gore's grandmother. The cornfields already caught fire because there are sunspots on the sun that explode, that project heat out into the universe and eventually reach our atmosphere. There are other natural phenomena. It's called weather, which they've turned into global warming, which is a business. Anyway, forget about it. New York, Joseph, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please. What's on your mind?
Hello? Yes. Hello, Michael. This is Joseph from Bronx. I'm an immigrant myself, came from 1956.
What a great story you must have escaping those killers.
I have, and I hate them. I hate them, but I came and I went to Fordham, and that's where I learned to become American. And there was a great writer who helped me, and his name is Gene Shepherd. I'm sure you know him or know
about. Oh, yeah, the radio talk show host.
Actually, the greatest storyteller. And he wrote a short story about his father, the greatest 4th of July I've ever had. And it was made for film with Matt Dillon. It is one of the most beautiful tribute to fathers. One of the most gorgeous, wonderful things. He wrote also a book called America, I Love You. And I have that book. America, I love you, and I thank you, Gene Shepherd. And Michael, I thank you to be a great American as you are. God bless you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I'm sorry that the other man got more accolades than I did, but okay, I'll accept it. I'm a big guy. yeah, all right. Now what? Now where do we go from here? I just got the rug pulled out from underneath me. Nah, what are you going to do? So what do you want to talk about today? The news? You want to talk about the oil, $139 a barrel? Can you believe what's going on in this world on the George Bush oil man? See, I told you that you saw nothing. About 6 months ago, I warned you that you've seen nothing yet for the damage that would be done in the last 9 months of the regime. And this is amazing to me how they're getting away with this. The Democrats are silent because they've been paid off. They've been smeared off. Otherwise, they would stop it. Hey, look. You can say all you want to do about the Republicans and George Bush, but the Congress is dominated by Democrats. How come they don't do anything about oil? Answer, because they don't want to. They've never had it so good either. Israel minister says alternatives to attack on Iran running out. Ho-hum. I've heard it before. I'm so tired of it. Israel's starting to remind me of the guy in the street who's lost his nerve and says, you take one more step and then you're going to one more step, one more. They're doing nothing. It's sickening to see a beautiful country like that that was once run by a woman with guts, turned into a nation that's not like that. Let's put it to you that way. It's sad. It's sad because the old men should be thrown out of office and put in jail in Israel. Excuse me. The young Turks need to take over that country or there's going to be nothing left. What sovereign nation on earth permits an enemy to fire rockets every day into its country and does nothing about it? A corrupt, degenerate old leadership like Olmert, that's who permits it. A stooge of the Bush administration. A stooge permits that to go on, but I don't know how the people take it. I don't understand it. Men are killed every day in Israel. Every day rockets are coming in, and they do nothing about it. So what are they waiting for? I don't know. But I'm sick and tired of hearing the one more step and we're going to do something. You know, it doesn't strike me as truthful, very truthful at all. It's just sad to listen to it and see it. It's like watching the whole West melt down because of corruption and weakness. Say, well, what are you going to do about it? What could I do about it? I'm one man of 300 and some odd million here in America with one man's opinion. What can I do about it? Nothing. At least I can sound off about it. I don't live in China yet. Obama hasn't become the Marxist leader of America where this voice and others that criticize the great one will be turned out, turned off the air. Obama is the most narcissistic candidate in the history of the presidency. Who is he? He's done nothing. Was he cured polio and cancer while I was sleeping last night? The guy's done nothing. In 2016, he says, I'll be wrapping up my second term as president. It's astounding to me. If the other side had one decent candidate, one real conservative, he would win 70-30. But because we have a retread, a Bush 3, it's going to be very doubtful as to whether or not we can avoid outright Marxism and Afro-Leninism running this country. You understand that or don't you? Forget it. Oh, I didn't finish the story. I only have a minute now. So I go in the pharmacy on Ellis Street. The guy says, I want passion flower. Who are you? I don't want it. Get out of my store, basically. I said, what are you getting so excited about? I don't have nothing. I have no herbal tea, he says to me. That's all he sold. So I said to him, well, I heard you sell herbal tea. I don't know who you heard from. I have nothing here. I'm a regular drugstore. So I said, calm down. I had to show him one of my books. He was afraid I was an inspector, in other words. I think he had been busted by the FDA for selling real products that work called herbal medicine instead of toxic chemicals that killed and addicted people called pharmaceuticals. So we got to talk, and he said, what's your problem? I said, I can't sleep. He says, look, mister, you're still wasting your time. He said, go across the street to Joe's Bar and have two shots of scotch and go home. You'll fall asleep. I have nothing for you. Well, eventually he gave me the passion flower herbal tea. I used it. I would brew it every night, and I slept like a baby in the arms of Buddha. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the big, bold sound of the Savage Nation blasting across America on this beautiful Friday. Celebrating America 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Fighting Marxism and perversion on a daily basis. Stopping the creep of degeneracy into the family, the church, the school. Celebrating dogs and cuisine. And rock and roll on Rock and Roll Friday. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, another wonderful Friday on the Savage Nation. With Frankie Lyman. Let me hear that song. I like this particular piece. It used to drive me crazy. Of course, I'm an older guy now. I don't care very much for it. So you can turn it off now. What are we going to talk about? Well, whatever. It's open mic to Mike Friday, as you know. Let's start with a picture I found of the great one. That is the great pretender, Obama. And I puzzled over this for 3 days, but we put it up on michaelsavage.com. Reuters, which, as you well know, is the most whack job of all of the media, has actually been publishing a picture of Obama with a halo around his head. And we put it up on michaelsavage.com under the headline, Crazy Media Shows Obama with Halo. I thought I was seeing things, but this has been up for days. It is actually a halo photoshopped around Obama's head, the arrogant one, the one with big ears, the man who has accomplished nothing, the Afro-Leninist Obama, that is. And so we put it up for you. We've never seen propaganda like this. I have never seen propaganda like this for a candidate in my life. The media is 100% the reason behind this invented candidate's ascent, and that's all I can tell you. We're in real trouble because on the other side of the aisle we have a retread who has fundamentally given the middle finger to the conservative voter, who is that's the only audience that can get him elected, is the conservative audience, and he said he doesn't even care about them. He has said that, this moron. He said he doesn't care about the conservative audience. He won't go on. Forget about my show. He won't go on any conservative talk show. Instead, he continues to appease and appeal to those who will never vote for him. This is, excuse me, the classic behavior of the country club check pants Republican that is fundamentally finished. And maybe it's time for them to be finished. But then again, what do we have as an option? An Afro-Leninist who's achieved nothing? So there it is. We're trapped. We the people really are stuck. I don't know what the choices are, and I don't want to talk about it. I don't really want to talk about it. Today is a celebration of D-Day, and veterans today remember the invasion of Normandy, without which you would be speaking German or you'd be a lampshade. You would be speaking German or you'd be a lampshade, because had the Nazis won, had the every man not stood up to Superman, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be living in a free world. You'd be living in a Hitler universe, which is amazing to me in a way how, well, most of us know it. Most rational people know that. Even Democrats know that. There's no question Democrats accept that as reality. It's the revisionists that bother me, number one. But amongst the revisionists, I would include Pat Buchanan. I have to say this right now. I didn't intend to talk about it, but I think it's a good time to mention it. I've had Pat on the show many times over the years, and I've heard people say things about him that I didn't like, and I supported Buchanan except in certain areas, but I figured, look, we don't have to agree on anything. But when he came out with his latest book, where he was a clear apologist for Adolf Hitler, and he said Hitler didn't want to invade Poland, Hitler didn't want to invade Czechoslovakia, Hitler was just trying to I could not believe what I was reading. And how people could not see that this man has become an apologist for Hitler is amazing to me. And so I figure I want you to understand that when you listen to me, you're not really hearing a guy who's on one side of the aisle or really. You know, I'm like wherever I am, I think wherever the truth leads me. I have phenomenal deductive skills, and I can conclude pretty rapidly what the reality is of the situation. I'm very lucky that I was trained in scientific methodology and thought. I also have a fairly good knowledge of history, and I have a lot of experience. And so when someone steps out of the line on the so-called conservative side, you'll hear me criticize them just as much as on the other side. And that's why the show is considered to be, let us say, the bridge for so many Americans who have nowhere else to go. That's the Savage Nation. But again, I don't want to be into the self-aggrandizing story. In fact, I just want to tell stories today, and I will do that if you wish. If you want to ask for some stories, I'll do them, or you want to talk about something else, you can do that. Let's go to Delaware. Jim, you're up on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind today? Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Never heard your show before. I just happened to tune in. I'm actually driving back to Manhattan. That's where I live. But I want to give you kind of a compliment from the other side of the aisle here, because I would describe myself as fairly liberal leaning, but I've certainly read a lot about you, and there's of course a lot of let's say bad press in the left-leaning media about you, which you won't be surprised. But actually I was kind of surprised and sort of impressed that you were also taking on some of George Bush's leadership, and I was especially stunned to say something about Reagan.
Well, I think you must be a new listener, because I've been very tepid about George Bush since the year 2000.
Yeah.
This is nothing new to me. I mean, he's the great pretender, that one. He is a classic big government liberal, internationalist, destroyed our borders, language, and culture. What is there to say about George Bush other than we're all shocked? There are certain things he has done that I approve of. He has kept taxes at a, I wouldn't say low level, but he certainly hasn't made them any more extortionist than they were when he inherited the nation. He has appointed judges who are moderately centrist. I wouldn't call them conservative by any means. And that was the counter the radical leftists put on the court a long time ago, predominantly the people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a former chairman of the ACLU, legal counsel for the ACLU, and other far leftists who steered the country almost into an iceberg. But welcome to the show, and thank you for listening. 1-800-449-8255, phone number. Any topic is fair game. New Jersey, Evelyn, you're up next. What's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I have a few things for you. You had a caller this week who said that they ran into someone who was in their car listening to you on the radio, and
yeah.
This individual apologized. Well, a couple of weeks ago in the Quick Check, a local convenience center, there was a man who pulled up in front of me blasting something, so I thought it was local boombox music, and he opened the door, and it was you. I went right over to him. We had the greatest conversation talking about you, and I said, thank God there's somebody with sanity in this city that will listen.
Well, particularly in New Jersey, I can't imagine that you're even allowed to listen to the Savage Nation in New Jersey. It's probably a Governor Corzine might make it especially illegal.
Dr. Savage, you have a big fan base in my family. My mother steered me in your direction several years ago, and she never steered me wrong. You're a man who speaks the truth. And also, I want to mention to you, you were talking about Jaguars and great cars.
Yes, and getting the back of the car broken by the Iraqi.
Sir, I had a 77 Grand Prix, and in 1992, the radiator went. And do you know it was the original radiator? The mechanics would not believe it. They don't make them like that anymore. But sir, you have
okay.
A big fan base, a lot of women. Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, that's because you grew up in a real family, an integrated family. And I'm saying, those who listen to the show, they don't, the first time they hear it, if I'm in a good mood, they like me. But if I'm in one of my angry moods, they usually, the women will turn it off. Women are afraid of anger. They don't like it. I know that. I happen to know it for a fact. I was gifted with a wonderful voice. God gave it to me, and it's a wonderful radio voice. And that draws, people into the tent. But you gotta do more than just use your voice. Otherwise, you're nothing but a disc jockey. And so there we are. From the midstream media to the mainstream of consciousness. Actually, it's from the midstream media to the mainstream of stream of consciousness, or the mainstream of consciousness. Right. I do a stream of consciousness show many of the times where I won't get in. I'll get in a topic and get sidetracked, which is where most of the good stuff in the show originates. Amarillo, Texas. Kim, you're up next on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Michael, I love your stories. I absolutely love the story about the senile senator and your caribou story about the Alaskan pipeline.
Yeah, the senile senator, Robert Byrd, is a shock that we have degenerated to the point that a clearly senile old man can still vote on issues of importance to the nation's security and health and well-being. Why don't they remove a senile senator and put him where he belongs or where he'll get his rest? Why must this man be? Why is this man allowed to continue to function? Would a surgeon who's senile be permitted in the operating room?
No.
No. But apparently there's no limit to what can go wrong with an individual who still is in the Senate. But what do they actually do? Let's analyze this. Hillary Clinton's been away from her job for well over a year, and apparently New York is still running. So what does she do for New York? Answer, nothing. What do any of them do? They're glorified lobbyists for special interests. They don't represent the people anymore. They do not go to Washington for the people to represent the people in the federal government. Tell me the last time you got an audience with your senator. You could probably get an audience with the Pope faster for less money. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Darling, you send me. I know you.
Sam Cooke, Darling You Send Me on the Savage Nation. So what's up there that you want to talk about? You want to talk about Obama and this and that? I'm not going to do it right now. Not really into it. I mean, some of you do. I'll take your calls because it's open mic to mic Friday. Ed, Chicago, welcome. You're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm a second-time caller. Let me give you a little different spin from a liberal Democrat who's really not enamored with Barack Obama at all, probably from a different perspective than you. In my book, he's not anywhere near liberal enough. For instance, I was looking at Dennis Kucinich and his proposals about ending the war in 90 days. Obama wants 16 months. And what I'm saying about Obama, you can say about Hillary Clinton, too. Okay? We have a problem with the homelessness in this country caused basically by the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. Neither one of them.
You mean all the bums on in the streets would be better off if we gave them more money?
Well, what would you do? Let them spend the rest of their life sleeping on park benches?
Why not put them in work camps? Most of them are able-bodied.
How much do you plan on paying them in these work camps, sir?
Well, since they're already receiving public assistance, I'd pay them nothing.
Well,
why do you have to pay a man who's right now living off the fat of the land, and he's sucking the fat of the land for a fairly small check, it is true, but he is a leech. He is not a productive member of society. Where is the money supposed to come from? No, I've studied the homeless problem for many years, Ed, because I live in one of the most infested cities in the United States, San Francisco, and I've observed the bums for many years. And the largest portion of them are able-bodied. They're drug addicts or alcoholics. There's no reason they could not be put into work camps and do much of the labor that our illegal aliens are doing. Now, who do you think did this labor in previous generations? It was ne'er-do-wells who today are basically able to live on the fat of the land and drink or use drugs because they're getting a check for nothing. In the old days, they'd pick the crops and they would spend their money on alcohol.
You're going to pay him slave wages. Why not do what Dennis Kucinich said and put him to work for the federal government, fixing up?
Well, because then you're getting into a Soviet-style economy, which I don't happen to think has proven to be very effective.
Mr. Obama, okay. Today he comes to Chicago, all right, and he's talking about the future Olympics, which we don't even know we're going to get. We have a serious problem here in Chicago that it seems like nobody but me is talking about. Hello, I'm right here. Yeah, it was my phone.
Yeah.
We have a problem in Chicago. Right now they're trying to arm our police officers with M4 carbines, which are basically machine guns. They fire 1,000 rounds a minute, 17 rounds a second. We don't need police officers in American cities running around with machine guns.
Wait a minute. Let's stop right here. You mean you need gangs with machine guns and cops with handguns?
Do you know another American city that has armed their entire police force with machine guns? Can you think of one?
Well, wait. Why is this proposal even on the table? It's because of the violence in Chicago.
The war on gangs and drugs in big cities is nothing but a bumper sticker slogan. It's like the war on terror. It's an excuse to give these right-wingers all the ammunition they need.
So you say there are no gangs in America?
There are gangs, but they're not running around shooting people, ordinary, everyday working people. They're basically...
Whoa, let's slow down. MS-13, do you know who they are?
We don't have them in Chicago.
Yes, you certainly do. You certainly do. You're making this up. They certainly do exist. Many of them are former military of the El Salvadoran army. They're ruthless murderers. The police are outgunned. I don't want to see any more police get killed. I'd be glad to see the cops have machine guns. Secondly, there's a secondary benefit to the cops having machine guns, which is when we do have this terrorist event, they'll be fully armed and prepared to take care of business with our dear friends from the Middle East who are sitting here waiting to attack us.
What about the ordinary law-abiding citizen? You know, in Chicago, we can't even legally possess a pistol. Do you think that's fair, sir?
No, but wait a minute. You see, you're mixing two things together. Would you like to possess a pistol?
We cannot own a pistol in Chicago, correct.
No, but Ed, we're having a reasonable conversation, even though we're both going to walk away disagreeing with each other. Would you like to be able to own a pistol?
Absolutely.
So if you would like to own a pistol, why is that you'd like to own a pistol? What do you need it for?
Property in my life.
Thank you. So you and I agree on the Second Amendment. I totally agree with you on that issue. It's one of the great benefits of being an American. One of the first things that Fidel Castro did was disarm all of the Cubans so he could turn them into slaves. The same thing Hitler did in his one of his first acts was take away the right to bear arms in Germany. We understand all of this, Ed. So if you're a libertarian or a liberal, whatever, but you still understand you have the right to protect your home and property, I mean your home and life, You need a gun to do that. You can't do it with persuasion.
And that's the whole issue, Dr. Savage. While they want to arm the police to the teeth, they want to disarm the law-abiding citizens. This has been going on in Chicago for a quarter of a century, sir.
So would you say you'd like the right to bear arms extended to yourself at the same time the police are up-armed with machine guns?
I want to have the same right to defend myself against the police as the criminals, because they can become criminals. Sir?
Well, I'm not saying that all police are angels, don't get me wrong, but if I were being mugged, I would call 911, not the ACLU.
Savage.
It is a 60th anniversary of D-Day, the... probably one of the most seminal days in the history of the United States of America, and I don't know who would argue with that other than crypto or overt Nazis. Veterans remember the invasion of Normandy. It was a pure miracle. You know how many men died? I don't. Tens of thousands of men died, particularly the first and the second waves of men. Virtually nobody survived. If you've, I guess Saving Private Ryan was a popular version of that one, and who wasn't moved by that film? I remember seeing that. That was one of Spielberg's great movies. I think they say the numbers are something like 14,000 to 19,000 men died on D-Day. And all told, the Battle of Normandy is said to have resulted in more than 425,000 casualties among Allied and German forces. I remember not every German soldier was a Nazi. They were just kids, you know, in the Wehrmacht, put out there. And they were somebody's son, somebody's lover, somebody's brother. The tragedy here is the butchery, and the tragedy here is man's inhumanity to man, and it was all started by one lunatic, Adolf Hitler, and today we have an equivalent lunatic in the psychotic in Iran. And had Hitler been killed in 35, 36, 37, 60 million people wouldn't have been killed. I am warning the world. I say it over and over again. I have no power. You have a Hitler reincarnated in this man with platform shoes from Iran. He is going to bring death and destruction not only to half of his own population, but possibly a good percentage of the world unless he is stopped. Why Israel doesn't do it, why the U.S. doesn't do it, I do know. And it all has to do with compromise. But remember, it's history reappearing or repeating itself all over again. As Santayana, the philosopher, wrote, those who do not know their history are condemned to repeat it. We are condemned to repeat the history of World War II unless this new Hitler is stopped. And that's the real message. That's the real message, in my opinion, of Normandy. And that should have been spoken today at one of many graduations across the country. And instead, I'm sure you heard about homophobia and racism. New York City, Jerry, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike, you're the man. I'm a New York City firefighter, and I listen to you all the time. Now I got guys in
Thank
the firehouse
you.
Every evening. They're addicted.
Thank God.
They're like, who
Thank
is
God. So, thank God someone in New York has a brain.
Oh, the liberals out here. But anyway, I want to get to you. My son graduated the University of Maryland 2 weeks ago, and the guest speaker was Carl Bernstein. Do you remember him from the Watergate?
Oh, yeah, a real exciting reporter, right. I thought he was in a crypt somewhere. What did he have to say?
Oh, Mike, instead of congratulating the children and the kids there and everything about their future, he went on about Watergate and how to get...
Oh, my God. No, these 60s people are stuck in amber, like they jumped into an amber pit. Like a dinosaur, they're stuck in it. That's all they can talk about. You know, patchouli oil and, you know, long hair and love beads.
But he went on and on. He was on for about an hour. It felt like three.
But, yeah, the kids probably didn't even know who he was.
He made a remark also about the Cold War, something about money for the Cold War scam. So I guess he was going after Reagan there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's got an old axis to grind. But I'll bet the kids didn't know who he was.
And then he made, you know, he spoke about Kennedy, you know, oh, what, you know, how he was enthralled with John F. Kennedy when he was a Cub reporter, and, you know, it was just so one-sided.
Did he push Obama? Did he get to conclude by, and if you love John F. Kennedy, you have to vote for the anointed one?
His exact words were, he goes, what a country we live in today where we can have an African-American running for president,
That unto itself, qualifies a human being to be the president?
But you know what he said?
It's like the fire department. They got women today in San Francisco who cannot lift the hose, who they turn into fire captains. They can't lift a hose with water running through it. When a fire breaks out, they run behind the truck and faint. They take out a bottle of water. You talk about being a fireman. I hear it from the firemen. They run behind the truck and have a hydration break during a fire. We have a police chief who hasn't fired a gun in 6 years. We have a police chief whose hat falls off her head. I know what's going on because of affirmative action, Jerry. Believe me, I know. So now we have an affirmative action candidate. That qualifies him unto itself? Simply because he's part black? That makes him a viable leader? What insanity is this?
What he said about McCain, he goes, and we have a cranky old man running.
Well, you mean he was talking about himself?
No.
He was talking about himself, a cranky old man. Look, these guys are passe. No one listens to them anymore. They're lucky that they have friends in the university who'll give them a few grand to come and harangue the children. Don't take them seriously. They have no cachet anymore. They're nobody. They're worse than old rock and rollers who won't get off the stage. Jerry, thanks for calling. You know, earlier this year, Barack Hussein Obama, the anointed one with the halo, delivered a major speech on race that is worth listening to. And what's important in this speech is to understand that his father ditched him, his second father, an Indonesian, ditched him, and the people, as hard as this is for me to say to you, the people who came to his rescue and sacrificed to send him to private schools was his white grandmother. But he put her down. I don't think you remember what he said about her. He implied she was a racist. Listen to clip 27.
I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me. And they
so he's saying that his grandmother, who cringed at black men, is a part of him, and so is Reverend Wright. That's what he said in that speech. These people are part of me. That's what worries me, is that Reverend Wright is part of him. I'd like to know which part of him. You know, that's what I'd like to know, which part of him. 1-800-449-8255 phone number. MichaelSavage.com website. Normandy is one topic. There are many others. I don't want to just sit here with talking about D-Day and all. It's a very important story, but there's not much more we can say about it that hasn't been said. That doesn't mean we should ever forget the significance of that day. There are many other stories, I suppose, that we can talk about, and you can do so by dialing the phone number. I'll take your calls right now on the program, and they'll go to Chicago. Matthew, go ahead, please.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Savage. I'm a little bit, I want to say disappointed. It seems like you're not giving Ted Buchanan a fair shot, Doctor. You know, a great man like him, an intellectual, a man that, like yourself, in a lot of ways, and people have taken a lot of stuff of yours out of context, and now they're doing the same thing with Pat. I read the article. I'm also disappointed in Buchanan from what I read. I read an article similar that he wrote in 77. I cross-referenced it, and he said just the opposite in the article in August of 77, and now he's going and saying this. But what I'd like you to do, Doctor, if you...
Well, wait, let's slow down. We're not arguing with each other. We're trying to clarify the record. I said Pat Buchanan has become an apologist for Hitler. Now, I read the article. I was shocked by what I read. I was shocked by it.
I guess, you know what, I was disappointed, too. I'm saying, where's he coming from now? In the article in 77, he said took just the opposite. He was talking about the appeasement that was going on, and he said how Hitler knew exactly what he was doing, and now he comes out and says this. So it's like, I guess what I really am asking you is if you can get him back on the show and discuss it with him, because you two guys, you know, been friendly through the years. He's been a good guest.
That's right. He's been a very good guest, but I don't think I want him on the show again. I mean, it's like an old friend who I can't talk to anymore. I don't hate him, but I cannot believe that the man would write an article based on his book where he says Hitler was forced to go to war with the West. Hitler was only trying to reconquer parts of Czechoslovakia that were really Germany. I couldn't believe what I was looking at.
My point is this. When we break friendships with old friends, I've learned in my life, and maybe you have the same thing, is a lot of times it's because of misinformation or just a misunderstanding of what we thought was being said, And when the person clarified it, when we actually, you know, came...
I understand, but wait a minute. I didn't get this from anybody else. I read his article in Human Events where he clearly said the things I am saying to you. And I was shocked by it. I was just shocked by the things he said. That he looked like a straight-out apologist for Adolf Hitler.
It didn't make sense, especially... Like I said, I read an article, and I cross-referenced it because I've been reading his articles for years, and I went back in 77, and he said just the opposite. And it's like, I said to myself, I'd like to hear why at least it came across the way you're saying.
Well, here, I'll read you what Pat Buchanan wrote himself. I have the article in front of me if you want to relive this. Let us see. Instead of following their principle of self-determination, the Allies placed under the rule of 7 million Czechs, 3 million Germans, 3 million Slovaks, 800,000 Hungarians, 150,000 Poles, and 500,000 Ruthenians. These foolish decisions spat upon Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, and he's laying the groundwork down there. He says, by 1938, Germany had arisen, rearmed, and brought Austria into the Reich, and was demanding the right of self-determination now be granted to the 3 million Germans in Czechoslovakia who were clamoring to be free of Prague to rejoin their kinsmen. Britain had no alliance with and no obligation to fight for the Czechs, but France did. And he goes on to say that fundamentally Hitler had a right to invade Czechoslovakia to liberate the Germans who were in Czechoslovakia. He goes on, it gets even worse. He goes on at every step arguing right here, Hitler intervened to guarantee the independence of Slovakia and gave Hungary a green light to re-annex Ruthenia. I don't want to read every word that he says. And he's apologizing for Hitler's, you know, naked aggression.
Yeah, on the one hand, you know, it definitely in this case he is. But like I said, years before, you know, like I said, I think it was 77, he said just the opposite. I don't get it myself. It doesn't make much sense to me where he's coming from. But like I said, Doctor, I think...
Yeah, but look what he says. He's trying to... He's not acknowledging that Hitler was a megalomaniac, a genius of a megalomaniac, bent on dominating the world. He's not even acknowledging that. And he wants to lay the blame on the Poles themselves, who would not give back to Germany what rightly belonged to them. That's what he's saying. It sounds like he's a member of Hitler's propaganda staff. Buchanan says nothing about Hitler's pact with Stalin to divide up Poland between them. He says nothing about Hitler's plans to attack Poland months in advance of September 39. He doesn't talk about the millions of Poles and Jewish Poles who were murdered by Hitler. He says nothing about that. It's amazing to me.
Right. In this particular article, he doesn't, but he has before. And so that's what I'm saying, Doctor. I think you'd want the same thing done to you if you wrote something and it was, you know, I would love to see you bring him back on at least.
Well, I used to think highly of Pat Buchanan, even though I disagree with him on certain points. Now, as I say, he's an old friend who I really cannot have back on the program. He has my wishes for good luck, but when he's showing himself to be nothing but an apologist for Hitler, I'm sorry. That's where the world changes for me. And I've lost friends. I've left friends behind in my life to even get where I am today, and it was the hardest thing in my life to do. I got to tell you that, Matthew. I had friends who were liberals 20 years ago, and in order for me to thrive, I had to step out and be who I was. These people never wanted you to say one thing that violated their belief system. They could not tolerate it. They would almost come apart at the seams. Yeah, well, guess what? I did so, and here I am, and they are still exactly where I left them. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back. It is the Savage Nation Rock and Roll Friday. Let me explain something. When I entered radio 15 years ago, and the word conservative was rather odd in San Francisco, particularly in radio, didn't exist. I remember saying to the program director that I am a conservative, but I have a firewall between conservatism and racism. And no one understood exactly what I was saying. I said, you can be a conservative, you can be an ultra-nationalist, but there's a firewall between that and racism. And, of course, that's the line I have towed for 15 straight years, despite what the enemies of the truth want you to believe. The communists, the socialists, the anarchists, the pervs, they'll twist anybody who stands up to their juggernaut of lies. So I've learned to live with that a very long time. But the fact of the matter is, Buchanan went over the line here. He's an apologist for Hitler, I read his article. I was shocked by it. I was stunned by it. And I know where he's coming from. I know exactly what he's saying. I'll be shocked if he does. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if he endorses Obama. And I'll tell you why. You say, how could that happen? He is vehemently anti-Israel, which he's entitled to be. But as a result, his mind has been colored to the extent that he doesn't even realize himself, in my opinion. He would say, well, Iran doesn't really want to go to war. Iran really is a peace-loving nation. Now, how could he say that when we have Ahmadinejad every other day saying Israel will not exist, the U.S. will not exist? Ahmadinejad is the Hitler of our time. He's repeating history. He goes to Japan 2 days ago and says, envision a world without the United States. He's doing a deal with Japan. Envision a world now without the United States. And we sit idly by. I suppose we have to sit idly by. I'm not sure we really do, but we do. Israel sits idly by while the old men and women get killed. They do nothing, even though they have the capacity to stop this. And now we have homegrown apologists like Pat Buchanan, not only for Hitler, but for Ahmadinejad. Chicago, Teresa, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thank you. I didn't go along with what you were just saying. I think that he definitely was along the lines of supporting Obama's foreign policy. He was basically saying, you know, if we support the Hitler of our times and, you know, giving him what he wants, then he's going to be nice and he's not going to invade other countries.
Right. He's trying to rationalize what Hitler did, that it wasn't really an invasion of Czechoslovakia, Poland, but just taking back what was his. That would be the same as saying Saddam Hussein was correct in taking Kuwait, and it shouldn't have been a first Gulf War because Kuwait used to be a part of Iraq.
Yeah.
Apparently, we didn't see it that way. That would be like saying permit Mexico to take the Southwest because it used to be part of Mexico. I mean, is that what you – that would be rationalized that. Why not just give it to Mexico by his logic?
Right. And if we, you know, if we do what we – you know, if we can listen to them and talk to, you know, the Hitler of our time and maybe
– Sure. Yeah, well, he doesn't understand that we understand what he's saying. Thank you for the call. Kevin, Las Vegas, go ahead, please.
Yes, I would just like to try to help you understand what Pat Buchanan was driving at there. And it wasn't appeasement and being an apologist for Hitler. What he was saying in that article, which is really just a small context of what he just wrote in his book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, is Hitler, I mean, Buchanan makes the argument that the West could have sat back and let Hitler and Stalin go to war together, and during that time, the West, Britain, and France could have built up their defenses and confronted a much weaker Germany or Stalin after that conclusion there. He's not being an...
No, that's not what he said at all. You're again glossing over many of the exact statements which I have in front of me. He said Britain had no obligation to fight for the Czechs. He said that. He also said that Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia to be granting self-determination to the 3 million Germans in Czechoslovakia who were clamoring to be free of Prague. So this is a little different than what you're saying.
But actually, in Czechoslovakia, right, it was an agreement hammered out in Munich. But in his book, he actually hammers out that England, after World War One, had let their military, their navy...
Well, before getting off the track here... You know, have you read any of Mein Kampf by Hitler?
Yes, actually, I have.
Okay. In Mein Kampf, he wrote, Hitler did, that he wanted to conquer Russia and turn them into slaves. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I do. I agree wholeheartedly with that.
In that book, he said that all Slavs were slaves and should be slaves to the Aryan. I don't know that Pat Buchanan makes any note of that. It seems he also glosses over the slaughter of 6 million Jews as though it didn't happen.
Well, no, he doesn't do that. What he does in his book, though, he does actually talk about the maniacal man that Hitler is and what a horrible person he is. But he just...
All right, so what exactly is his point? That Hitler was a nice guy or he wasn't a nice guy and we had no right to go to war with him?
No, that the West was not prepared to go to war against Hitler when they did.
Why was the West not prepared to go to war when they did, when Hitler had been disarmed, when Germany had been disarmed by the Treaty of Versailles? He secretly rebuilt the Navy and the Army and the Air Force. He was not allowed to do so, but he did so. So he was planning war long before the West even knew it.
That's correct. And in his book, he actually talks about how France should have actually, when Hitler first came into, is it the Rhine there, that was demilitarized, France should have stepped in, and it could have, and actually there was an entente between France.
Look, the bottom line here is that Pat Buchanan hates Israel and says that we are owned by Israel. He has said so for years. To me, this borders on some very, very dangerous rhetoric that is right out of the Third Reich itself, and I'm not going to tolerate it myself, because it's not true.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Little Anthony and the Imperials, Tears on My Pillow, The Savage Nation. It's Rock and Roll Friday. You know, today's show is like a reversal of yesterday's show. Yesterday's show was political for 2 hours, and then it was personal stories for 1 hour. Today I've done sort of stories for the first hour and a half, and we're moving into politics. Today is the anniversary, the 60th anniversary, I believe, of the invasion of Normandy on D-Day that guaranteed us our freedoms. Guaranteed us our freedoms. We wouldn't be here today had the men not died on that beach and, of course, in other places and skies over Germany and Romania, over Italy, on the beaches in the South Pacific, you name it, Americans died so that I could be here on the microphone and you could be free to listen to me on your radio. Think about the power of freedom, and think about how despots then and despots now would like to take away this power of freedom. We have little dictators in this country who are trying to pass the so-called fairness doctrine, who are mini Hitlers. They don't want you to hear what they don't want you to hear. They want you to hear what they want you to hear. They could be conservatives. They could be liberals. At the end of the day, they're nothing except little petty tyrants, and you must resist them, especially if you are a liberal. Especially if you are a liberal, you must resist this call for fascism, and it's coming from you liberals, which is very interesting. Now, I won the Freedom of Speech Award last year at the Talkers Convention. I don't know who will get it this year. I hope it's a good prize. And I thought I gave a great speech on what the meaning of the freedom of speech really is, and I won't bore you with it now. Many of you bought the DVD. However, we're also celebrating D-Day itself, and as a result, we're also talking about Normandy. We're talking about Hitler. We're talking about World War II. That's how these issues arose in the last hour. I have a very special treat for you, because up next there's going to be an interview with Ken Burns, who did the most amazing documentary called The War. I have the book, I have the DVD, and I watched it when it first came out. I was extremely moved by it, because The War, although it's a documentary, is told through the personal stories of a few Americans and how they were tracked from being ordinary citizens to becoming, you know, flyers or seamen or infantrymen. And how it affected them, and how it affected their lives, and it's stirring and stunning. I believe that this documentary by Ken Burns should be viewing, I would say, required viewing for everybody in K-12, to teach them what a great country this is and whose sacrifices preceded them. Having said that, we're also talking about another story related, which is the sudden and naked appeasement of Adolf Hitler, as apparent to me in Buchanan, Pat Buchanan's article in Human Events. Palm Beach, Terry, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
It's 64th anniversary, I believe, though, by the way.
Okay, yeah, I'm off on the years. I thought it was something around 60, but go ahead.
No, I think you're completely right about not having him on your show. You can't be like Barack Obama. You can't hang out with trash. You start to smell like it, and you should teach him a thing or two about that.
Well, apparently the Leprechaun and he don't seem to disagree on this very much. He was on the Leprechaun show waving the book around, I hear.
He's crazy. I don't get much chance to watch TV. I'm pleased.
No, I hear you. Yeah, to each his own. And you can tell an awful lot about people by who they will have and who they will not have on their program. New York, Vincent, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, hi, Dr. Savage. Really is a pleasure to speak to you. I think a major component of Buchanan's article, as well as his book, is that you really have to watch and you really have to be cognizant of possible unnecessary entanglements and alliances, because World War II really did bring down the end of the British Empire. And
I understand all of that, but to then go to the extent and say Hitler didn't want to go to war and he was dragged into it is ludicrous.
I think Hitler,
let's start with this. German rearmament and state-sponsored discrimination of Jews and other minority groups were already occurring for years before 1939. So Buchanan is all wrong. And Hitler could never have been assuaged into a peace-loving, tranquil man, even if Danzig had been rejoined to the rest of Germany. This man wanted to have his war no matter what. In fact, Hitler wanted his war so badly that he launched it 5 years before his own military advisors told him that Germany would be ready for it. So, in other words, you have to know the history of the situation in order to even argue about this.
I totally agree with your statement on that. I think Hitler's armament, I think one of the major reasons for that was that he wanted to go in and to crush Russia. I know that...
He could want to go in and crush Russia. What are you going to do, kill all of the Russian people?
Kill the communists.
I see. So, in other words, only the communists would die when he dropped bombs on Stalin. On Stalingrad. Only communists died when he dropped bombs on Stalingrad. The same way only Nazis died when we firebombed Dresden.
Absolutely not. There were many cultures and many ethnicities that were.
And only Japanese imperialists died when we dropped a bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's ludicrous. Look, it was total war. Everybody hates war except madmen. I hate war. You hate war. We're all against war. But what are you going to do if a man is at your gate, shaking the gate, demanding he's going to come through that gate and kill you? Are you going to wait till he breaks through the gate and then breaks through your front door? Or are you going to shoot him in the driveway?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. You do have to prepare yourself.
Well, Hitler was shaking the gates of Western civilization. He had to be stopped. He would have taken over the world. It's crazy for Buchanan to argue he was not seeking to dominate the world. He was.
The West, and I'm talking about as far as France, England, and the United States
Appeasement is appeasement. Buchanan has become an appeaser because he doesn't like Israel and he wants to appease Ahmadinejad, who he says has a legitimate right to hate the West. Now, what kind of American would write that in this day and age and call himself a conservative?
I'd
expect that from Barack Obama or from the far left Marxists. I wouldn't expect it from Pat Buchanan, and yet it's the same rhetoric.
The problem is, if the U.S. goes into Iran, I just don't know if we have the money to fight. And you know what?
Nobody is saying, not even the war planners are saying we should go into Iran with boots on the ground. And I have said over and over again, and I'm no war planner, that this could be done with a naval blockade. You don't even need an aerial campaign. You could starve Iran into submission until they threw the man out themselves. You could block everything going in and everything going out of Iran without killing anybody. Eventually, the people would overthrow the psychopath in platform shoes. They are peace-loving people. They hate him. They hate him in Iran. He's hated. It's only a small band of extremist Muslims called mullahs who like this psychopath. They're destroying the Iranian economy. They're destroying freedoms in Iran. They're hanging homosexuals. It's not the Iranian people doing it. They set the country back hundreds of years. So as I say, if you blockade Iran, the people will overthrow this Ahmadinejad. No one's saying go into Iran and invade them. But we don't even want to do a naval blockade. We have, what, three carrier groups in the area who are doing nothing but having naval practice on aircraft carriers? I feel that we have become very much like the Russian Navy did before Japan shocked it in the battle, the very famous battle in the, I think it was the Sino-Japanese War, when the Japanese suddenly attacked the gigantic dreadnoughts of the Russian Navy and sank most of the Russian Navy because they had become bloated. The Russian Navy had become a bloated Navy, top-heavy, bureaucratic, rigid, incapable of maneuvering, incapable of creative thinking. That is what I'm talking about. That's what our military has increasingly become under this bureaucratized United States of America. It's very much like a giant corporation that has no creativity. They all say, let's think outside the box. They don't even know what the word means, because the only people thinking outside the box are not inside the box to begin with. Men like me think outside the box because we're not in the box. Men inside the box have a lot of trouble thinking outside the box because they cannot do so. And to get back to the point I'm trying to make, the Russian Navy, which was one of the most powerful navies, if not the most powerful navy in the world, was suddenly and absolutely wrecked in the battle with Japan. It changed the whole history of Russia. And if we're not careful, we're liable to see some of our capital ships sink to the bottom of the sea if we don't get some real leadership in the United States Navy. That's my opinion. This is The Savage Nation. Coming up next, Ken Burns with his great documentary, The War, right here on The Savage Nation. Celebrate Normandy.
Savage.
Today is the 64th anniversary of D-Day. Conservatives know what that means. Liberals don't. The sacrifices American soldiers and our country made to ensure our victory in World War II are probably unmanageable by today's narcissistic standards. A while ago, Ken Burns made a documentary entitled The War, and it looked into what really went on during that time of sacrifice. It was an amazing documentary. I have it. I've read the book. I personally think that The War should be required viewing for every child from K through 12. Here is the interview I did with Ken Burns about that documentary, The War. Ken Burns, glad to have you on the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
I've watched this amazing film, and I've seen a lot of World War II documentaries, but the footage in your film is extraordinary. Some of it apparently has never been aired before. I've never seen this footage, and I've seen an awful lot of World War II footage. I've watched every documentary I could. How'd you find this footage? Who helped you research it?
Well, we've worked on this film for more than 6 years, and we visited archives, hundreds of archives around the world, including those in Tokyo and Berlin and Moscow and London. Most of the archives were American archives, and our primary source of research was the National Archives for both the still photographs and the footage. We've probably looked at thousands of hours of film, and a lot of it just hasn't been seen since it was first exposed. Outtakes from old newsreels, footage that turned out to have been originally shot in color, and us tracing it back to the original negative have given us an access to the Second World War that I think most documentaries have not been able to have, and a lot of that comes from the luxury of the time we spent researching it. As for the number of researchers, we've just had a handful of people, those of us most principally engaged in the production, who did that research.
Most of the footage came to you without sound, but the sound in the film is incredibly realistic. How was that process conducted?
Nearly all of the footage is without sound. So when you see those old newsreels from the period, even then they were adding rudimentary sound effects. We felt it was incumbent upon us, because this is the last moment to bring these stories alive with the accompanying first-person testimony of the people who were there. We felt that it was incumbent upon us to tell what it was like. So for years, we painstakingly researched what a actual American plane sounds like next to a Japanese one, what a German 88 gun sounds like firing from a mile away, a mile, just right up close, what the discharge shell sounds like as it hits the ground or pavement or snow or mud. And we put literally thousands and thousands of effects together in a way that hopefully you don't notice. It just puts you uncomfortably into the battles we want to bring alive. Our main objective was to first bear witness to the testimony of these unusually and reticent soldiers who for most of their lives have not told their personal tales of battle, And the Second World War has been so smothered over with bloodless, gallant myth that we forget what really takes place in war. So it seemed to us our responsibility was to hear them out and then try to recreate what they saw with the actual footage and to bring it alive. And I think it puts you uncomfortably in that. I remember a woman, a middle-aged woman, not a World War II buff, certainly not a filmmaker, said to us after she'd screened the whole thing, "Boy, it's really tough, but don't take out a single dead body." For her, it was so important to sort of master the horror by dealing with it and understanding what actually took place and not continue to buy into the bloodless gallant myth, the John Wayne version of the Second World War.
Absolutely. Most films about this war tend to focus on one or two events. You'll see a Hiroshima, a Pearl Harbor, an Omaha Beach, and that's it. You people focused on all of the events, and more importantly, the people living those events and their experience.
You know, you've got two kinds of documentaries, it seems to me, about the Second World War. One has got the aerial view that provides you all context and no intimacy. And then you get the ones that are intimate, but they're only one specific moment or idea, or they take the atomic bomb and they abstract it. They pull it out and talk about it abstractly, as if you cannot deal with it in context. It was our idea to tell the story intimately, but the whole war. And so we've created a film that is the first documentary that covers the European and the Pacific theaters of war and the home front simultaneously. That is to say, as they happen, as people anxiously waiting at home for news of their loved one heard not only about the landing at D-Day, but then a few days later, the invasion of Saipan. That's the way it happened to people, and we wanted to wash over our viewers in much the same anxious, partial way. Nobody ever knew what was going on or what the context was. For example, the dropping of the atomic bomb came after months and months and months of us already bombing and killing hundreds of thousands of civilians. And the bomb saved not only 500,000 American lives in another 3 or 4 years of war, but perhaps as many as 7 or 8 million other Japanese lives. And that's a huge equation that no one talks about when they discuss the Second World War, and particularly the dropping of the atomic bomb. We wanted to give you a sort of street-level, battle-level view of what it was like, and also, conversely, what it was like to be at home and work and worry and grieve in the face of that struggle. Early in the film, Sam Hines, a Marine pilot, says, "There's no such thing as a good war. There's only necessary or just wars." And we put that at the head of the film because we wanted to make that point and to show what it was like. War is the lie of civilization, but it is also paradoxically a place where not only the worst of human beings comes out, but the very best. So we wanted to be open to all of those ways. I mean, every soldier who has been in battle, every soldier who has experienced that agonizing dichotomy that when their life is most threatened, they experience life to its top, knows what it is to feel, "I was scared, I was bored, I was hot, I was cold, I saw bad things, I did bad things, I lost good friends." This is common to wars for as long as there have been wars. It's common today in Iraq, it was common in Vietnam, in the Second World War, the First World War, our Civil War, all the way back through ancient history. That's what happens in wars, and that's what we wanted to be open to, and just show that without political judgment. This film does not have a political axe to grind or make commentary on the current situation. It just wants to bear witness to the horrible truth of war.
We'll be back with more with Ken Burns, The War.
Savage.
Here is more of the amazing documentary, Ken Burns, The War. Well, because of that horrible truth, many of these people have never spoken about their experience, not even to their families. How were you able to develop such a strong trust that they were able to open up to the production process?
I have been conducting interviews for 35 and a half years, and I still feel like a student. And my co-director and co-producer, Lynn Novick, and I would go to people, and it was important for them to understand that they could trust us. Many of them were speaking for the very first times in their life about the most dramatic and traumatic experiences they ever went through. And 60-plus years ago, they came back and hid that stuff away in the deepest, darkest, safest chambers of their hearts and their souls. And it was our task to forgive those who did not want to speak, who still could not speak, and we came across hundreds of those. but to when we found someone willing to open up, to show them in every gesture and breath, in every second of the interview, that we were there not to exploit or to take this stuff and run, but to honor their experiences. And that's why the words that are so meaningful to me that we heard in an interview was, "Pop, you never told us that before." And then we knew we were in the presence, at the birth of express memory, and that's what our job was, and to honor them and to intertwine and interbraid their story with the next individual story, all of them people that aren't famous, people you and I could have had Thanksgiving with, and then put them, the collective stories, up against a structure that could communicate the larger view of the Second World War, the greatest cataclysm in human history. It wasn't easy. It produced lots of tears and no small amount of emotion. But I think that viewers will see that there's something different going on in this film, and I guess, is the reason why the DVDs and the books and the soundtrack are flying out of the stores. Well, people have written to me and talked about cathartic experiences they've had with their parents, that veterans have sent me dirt from Omaha Beach and Iwo Jima, that people want to talk and share their stories. This has become a hugely important event, and we are so grateful for the very simple process that began with, tell us what happened and how you felt.
Well, these personal testimonies are so important because the people involved in World War II are dying at a remarkable rate, and we're going to lose information of this type forever. I'd like to know about the continuation of the project with the Library of Congress and the Veterans Oral History Project.
You know, I made a film on the Civil War 17 years ago, and I vowed after that I would not do anything more on war. It was just too emotionally wrenching. But over the 1990s, people would beg me to do something on this war or that war, usually the Second World War, usually from aging veterans or their children, anxious that their parents' long private dramas be finally shared. And when I learned that we're losing 1,000 veterans a day of the Second World War, I realized I had to put aside my own little conceit and dive back into this maelstrom, into this whirlpool, into this compelling and demanding story of what war is like, because we could not have made this 10 years ago. They just weren't talking in the same way. And in 5 years, most of them will be gone. And the Second World War will become just abstracted by historians. No matter how good they are, they couldn't help but abstract it. So we felt the time was right to do this. And it wasn't just, you know, we chose 4 geographically distributed towns, almost with darts on a map. And we got to know 40-plus people in the course of our investigations out of, you know, hundreds and hundreds that we spoke with. And those 40 people stand in for everyone else who fought in the war, just as those 4 towns stand in for any 4 towns. And we recorded them, but we knew that our film should be only the beginning, only the drop of the stone, the pebble in the pond that radiates out. And so we've partnered with the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, which has been up and running for several years, mandated by Congress to record the testimony of veterans from all our wars, but particularly the Second World War, because we are losing them so often. And we are encouraging our kids, many of whom don't even know what happened in the Second World War, many of them thinking that we fought with the Germans against the Russians instead of the opposite, all have DV cameras. And if they go to the Library of Congress website, loc.gov, and type in the Veterans History Project, or go to pbs.org/the war and follow the prompts to the Veterans History Project, they can download from us some very simple lighting and shooting instructions and some sample questions, and then they can get grandpa or great-grandpa, grandma or great-grandma, Uncle Charlie, the old guy down the street, and we might be able to add for posterity tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of stories of what it was like in that magnificent moment in our history where, in shared sacrifice, everybody working together at home and on the front lines, the shared sacrifice we made ourselves richer, not only as individuals and as communities, but as a country, as a nation, and it is the best story I know. We have the tools right now, the very, very simple tools of the net, of tape recorders, and particularly of these DV cameras that permit us to get to just about everybody and record their stories. And you know, it doesn't take very long, a half an hour or an hour. And what it does is it has a special, special benefit. It binds families together. We've already heard, in just the few weeks since the series was aired, from thousands of families that have taken on these projects, and the kids and even the great-grandkids have been involved. And that's a wonderful thing. It sort of binds the families and communities together. They're helping to realize that these veterans are passing from their midst, and we have to find some way to honor and celebrate them. And one of the best ways you can do it is to sit down and listen to them.
In World War II, there was food rationing. There was gas rationing. We had scrap drives. Today we're attacked, and President Bush tells me to go shopping. When are we going to return to the idea that we need that kind of solidarity? We need to emulate the lessons learned from the men and women of World War II.
You know, as we said in the film, the war touched every family on every street and every town in America, and it is so different from today. In shared sacrifice back then, we made ourselves richer. Today, we're all independent free agents, unwilling to give up anything, and we have a separate military class that suffers its losses apart and alone from the rest of us. And that's not a good thing. We're being told by our leaders that the threat today is as great as the threat that Nazi Germany posed. If that's the case, why aren't we all engaged? After 9/11, we were asked to go shopping. If my president had come to me and said, I need you to do these 50 things, to give up these things, I would have done it willingly. And so I think we can draw on the lessons of the Second World War to understand how it is that we can re-energize ourselves, not focus so much on the partisanship, the red state, blue state divide that seems to always be the beginning and the end of all conversations, but to understand what we share in common, not what divides us. The historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who passed away, said, we suffer today from too much pluribus and not enough unum, referring to the Latin motto of the United States, out of many, one. And he's absolutely right. There's few things in our daily lives that remind us of the personal as well as collective blessings that come from the shared sacrifice that we do together. And so I hope that our series on the war, without being overtly political, because that would be self-defeating, just reminds people of what our possibilities are.
I think your film is so remarkable that it should be required viewing, not only in every school in America. It should be required viewing, I would say, in grade school and then in high school and certainly in history courses. And thank you very much, Ken Burns.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Savage.
The idiot pollsters like the Rasmussen poll, which has been wrong every time I've ever looked at it. Yet they keep having them on the shows, and these pundits tell you what they think, and people show sigh. They're never right. I've never seen anything like it, and yet these shows go on and on and on. And so here we go. We go to the callers on the Savage Nation in the waning moments of this hour. The interview with Ken Burns is really important. Again, I recommend it. You got to watch this DVD of the war, and who knows how many generations are left, if any, that'll even remember what side the United States was on and that we were the good guys fighting world fascism. Norfolk, Virginia, Chris, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, I saw the most horrible thing last night. I saw a TV interview with Pat Buchanan where he said the Holocaust was America's fault for going into the war.
Now, what show was he on?
Now, there's two news shows on Comedy Central, and I always watch them together, so I couldn't tell you which one it is, but it's either Colbert Report or The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Well, I'm telling you, the guy has become an outright apologist for Hitler, according to what I have read of his article in Human Events, and it's that's where I closed the door to him.
Well, basically, the title of the book being The Unnecessary War, where he got that from was Winston Churchill saying to the British government that the war was unnecessary. It shouldn't have happened if we would have taken all these preventative measures. And then 50 million people wouldn't have died in the war. But then he went on from there and said we should have let Hitler do whatever he wanted. First of all, he said that Hitler didn't want to take over Poland. He just wanted the one city that was German. And then he said that Western Europe was indefensible, and that what we should have done is draw a red line in the sand in France and say, if you cross this line, then we're going to attack you. West of that, you can have the rest of the world. We don't care. And that,
well, he's an apologist in this sense. If you've read Mein Kampf, which I actually read as a little boy quite by accident, Hitler had a long-term plan to dominate the world. He was a megalomaniac. who wanted to conquer the world. It makes no sense to say that he didn't want to invade Czechoslovakia but was forced to do so. I read the article with astonishment. I couldn't believe what I was reading.
Well,
so, for him to go to the next step and say that the war gave us the Holocaust, when in fact Hitler wanted the Holocaust before the war, shows a man who's, I believe, prejudice has completely clouded his reason. And it's a terrible thing for me to say this, because I had Pat Buchanan on for years and years and years when others were attacking him. And I've left other friends behind, and I still consider him a friend in a way, even though we never met. But I'll never have him on the show again. I will not give him any airtime. Thanks for the call. That's all. New York, Al, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dave, Michael Savage. I've been a communist half my life, and when I outgrew it during the Czech invasion by Brezhnev in 68, 67, I started to look deeper into Russian history.
Right.
On Buchanan, I have a very negative attitude. I recall incidents of Nazi or Gestapo guards that he would defend going back 25, 30 years ago.
Well, I believe it was Buchanan, if you want to open up the can of worms, who suggested that Ronald Reagan go to Bitburg, the cemetery in Germany where the SS were buried.
No, who suggested it, Michael? Okay.
I believe that I read that it was him.
The other thing, Michael, to mention, during the Hitler-Stalin pact, Hitler wanted Stalin to get rid of half to three-quarters of his officer corps. They were Jews. 350,000 to 450,000 Jews were killed in the conflict.
I know. As a matter of fact, when the Soviet military elite were killed, and it was in the massacre was in the forest of Poland, where many of the Soviet officers were executed by the Stalin did that himself. Stalin killed most of his officer corps before the war and debased the Russian military as a result.
The point I wanted to bring out there, Michael, is that when Hitler invaded Stalin, Russia, Stalin didn't respond for about 3 weeks to a month, because evidently he took out the officer corps that was mostly Jewish. And
you're saying that the Russian officer corps was peopled with Jewish people?
Yes, because they were taken out of their homes in childhood, and not to have them be raised in a...
Oh, forcibly conscripted into the Russian military, and as a result of their intelligence, they rose to the highest levels.
That's right. And when he, I believe, called them back in, either he said, I'm sorry, or whatever, it brought them back in, and Russia, it took about a month, 3 weeks to a month, Michael, that Russia drove back and defeated Hitler's Eastern Front.
You're saying that Stalin let Hitler do this, and then he counterattacked.
No, I don't know about that. It was that he had to reinforce his army, and he had to bring back the officers that he let go, because
we're talking about World War II, and it's a very, very important discussion, but we're going to get lost in the minutiae here. What if someone said to you was the primary reason for your calling, Al? What would that be?
The receiver, that your call receiver wanted me to comment on Buchanan, and but I initially wanted to call on that moment in history during the Stalin-Hitler pact.
I hear you. Look, this is a very important issue when we have a leading conservative thinker in America, who I have respected for so many years, to write an article that I had to reread it three times to see what I was reading. He actually wrote that Germany was not wanting to fight. Hitler didn't want to take over the world. It was crazy, the article.
Very ugly commentary by Pat Buchanan, and just that.
Look, I don't like historical revisionism, particularly when we know the truth is the opposite of what's in this article. This is historical revisionism, and if I've spent 15 years attacking the left for historical revisionism, where they keep attacking America and the founding fathers, By God, I don't care which side is doing their revisionism. I have to stand here and say I disagree with it.
Michael, and just to add, the sacrifices of the Russian people and the Jewish people, especially among the Jews, is not publicized or exposed to the world or to the public or to the Russians, because the Jews were not to be praised, and it's a secret. It's a big secret, whatever niceness would come in general from the Jewish people. But just to throw in a remark.
I hear you. Well, I believe that Buchanan has become an outright apologist for Hitler, and that's where the curtain has dropped for me, and I thank you for the call. He's saying World Wars I and II were unnecessary. Well, he's now a man who is saying that we have no right to stand up to Ahmadinejad, who has threatened Israel. We know that. That we know. He said Israel will disappear. But just 2 days ago, the man with elevator shoes, the man with platform shoes, the ugliest man in international politics, the man who looks like a jackal, Ahmadinejad, he has the ugliest, most terrifying face. He doesn't even look human. He looks like a werewolf to me. This man went to Japan to try to triangulate America, cut America out of the loop with Japan, one of our staunchest allies. And he said to the Japanese leadership, imagine a future without America. There will be no America. And we're sitting here listening to American apologists, homegrown apologists, say that we have no right to go to war with Iran or to navally to blockade Iran with a naval blockade or to bomb the nuclear facilities of Iran. How in the world could we sit here and repeat the lessons that we learned in World War II? Those who do not know their history are condemned to repeat it. Had Hitler been stopped at Munich, World War II would have been avoided. No, Buchanan has it 180 degrees wrong. Had Hitler been stopped earlier, there would have been no World War II. Not had Hitler been allowed to go ahead and take first Czechoslovakia, then Poland, and then every other nation that he wanted to. That's why we're talking about it today. Historical revisionism is very dangerous, and that's it. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. MichaelSavage.com is the website. We're talking about many important topics. Of course, you can comment on these if you wish. The real sad story today is that D-Day is not taught in our schools anymore, and you know why. And, of course, the reason is because the communists and the leftists have taken over our educational system. The children are fed a steady diet that America is a bad nation, a racist nation, a homophobic nation. And this is so deadly for the future of this country that you must do everything in your power to counteract the communists who are running our American schools. Make no mistake about it. This is naked communism. They hate this country. They're poisoning your children's minds as though they are putting poison in their food. It's even more dangerous to poison the mind than it is to poison the body. Because a poisoned body can recover with an antidote. And the antidote to a poisoned mind, my friends, is sometimes not available. Not when you grab them from infancy. And our children have been stolen from us by this communist educational system for which there is virtually no competition. The only answer is competition in the school system. Homeschooling is one step. Religious schools are another step. But most importantly are your parents, to teach your children to respect and love America and the sacrifices of the U.S. military.
Savage.